Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all. My name is Trisha Griffith. This is Web Sleuths Radio and WebSleuths.com, one of the best true crime discussion forums in the universe, in my opinion. I'm very proud owner of that forum. And tonight we welcome I call him my partner in crime, although we do not actually commit crimes, not yet anyway. Levi Page. Levi, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Trisha. Don't get me arrested.
I won't. I'll try not to. Now, this is so hard to believe, but it's been a year since the massacre in Las Vegas. Mandalay Bay, Stephen Paddock brought all the guns up to his room. I mean, I lost count of how many guns that lunatic had. He opened fire on the concert goers from his room, and 58 people were killed. Hundreds, maybe even up to 800 or more injured. Now, that's bad enough. We don't need to make anything worse, but it does get worse because there were some very vital mistakes made. There are questions unanswered. And there is one guy, speaking of universe, there's one guy in this universe who has spent the last year 24/7 trying to get the answers for us. His name is Doug Papa. He is a columnist with the Baltimore Post-Examiner, also former detective, and basically all-around great guy. Welcome, Doug Papa. I appreciate you coming on tonight.
Good evening, Trisha. Thanks for having me back on the show. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, let's just start at the beginning in case somebody has been living in a cave with the Taliban and they are not familiar or they have forgotten about this horrible night a year ago tomorrow. That's just Doug, about how that happened. He got there, he got the guns in his room, and kind of lead us up to the time that he first opened fire.
Yeah, it's been a long year, you know, over 100 stories. I've been on this thing since the night it happened, and just kept writing and digging. And luckily for me, I got quite a few police officers that gave me a lot of information, and some other people, you know, outside the police department. But anyway, yeah, it was October 1st. Paddock was in about a week in the Mandalay Bay Hotel. He had the suite on the 32nd floor, 135, and he also, I believe, was on the 29th when he requested the adjoining room, 134. And both in the suite and the adjoining room are connected inside by an adjoining room door. So you have the main double door entrance into the suite, 135, and then you have the single door from the hallway going into 134. And then in the suite, you have that adjoining door. You know, if you've ever been in a hotel, they got the adjoining doors that connects.
Yeah.
You know, you open and you go from 134 to 135. And mm-hmm. during the stay, he brought in what they estimate, according to the police reports, 23 firearms, thousands of rounds of ammunition, loaded magazines, a bunch of ancillary equipment, scopes and drills and stuff. Set up his own little surveillance camera system in the room, so he had a visual of who was approaching from the hallway outside. He had a camera installed on the double doors on the peephole, which would have given him a direct view down the hall. He had two cameras on a room service cart that he had outside 134, and he installed two cameras on there, and then he had that video feed going into several monitors inside the room. And according to what the police say, the police reports, and which I guess came from body camera footage and some other things, he opened fire about 10:05 at night on October 1st. It was a Sunday night. Fired for about 10 minutes, and 10:15 the firing stopped. And of course, we know what happened in that 10-minute period: 58 people dead, over 400 hit by gunshots and shrapnel. From the bullets, and hundreds of others were injured with all different types of injuries. Go ahead.
I was going to say that pretty much is the very basics. And we're going to get into the timeline and a few other things that are still a bit confusing for everybody. But let's talk about some of the mistakes right off the bat here. fair mistake, Doug, that you can think of that is the top one, just that you can't that actually happened? Or are there many mistakes that are equally as horrible?
Well, there was a lot of things that should have been done prior to the October 1st. And, you know, it was the Route 91 Music Festival that was occurring across the street from the Mandalay Bay on Las Vegas Boulevard. And it was attended by, in that three-day period, a three-day music festival, somewhere about 22,000 people. Now, I don't know if it was 22,000 mm-hmm. people actually in there that night when you opened fire, but they say 22,000. That could be from that night or the total of 3 days. You know, the first one you have to blame for this, the first one is Stephen Paddock. He was
Absolutely.
The mass murderer. He was the mm-hmm. sniper from an elevated position out of his suite and fired down on that crowd. So that's who you blame. However, putting that aside, you have to look at that there were no security measures in place in the Mandalay Bay that prevented Paddock from bringing in those 23 firearms and thousands of rounds of ammunition and all this other equipment. And also, which a lot of people, if they didn't read the police reports, don't know, is that he also drove his vehicle onto the property because he was driving mm-hmm. from there back and forth to Mesquite, Nevada, where he had his house. And they found in his vehicle 50 pounds of total, I think, of explosive material, tannerite. There were bags of ammonium nitrate in there, and, of course, more ammunition. So he knew that because he frequented the Mandalay Bay, and then he frequented other hotels on the Strip also because he was a prolific gambler, mostly video poker. So he exploited the weaknesses at the Mandalay Bay. He knew that when he drove his vehicle onto that property, that there was no screening being done. There were no canine handlers, dogs out there, you know, walking around cars. They didn't do vehicle searches. And he knew that taking all this luggage in, which was, I think, 10 to 15 suitcases somewhere around there, from what the police say, and then there was some gun case. Anyway, he brought all this stuff up into his room, and he knew that there was no screening going on. There was no luggage screening. There was no explosive mm-hmm. detection, anything like that, metal detectors.
Right.
So he exploited the weaknesses of the hotel and got that equipment and those weapons into his room. And so I've been saying in all my stories that this should never have happened. It's been a catastrophic failure of security for MGM Resorts International, the owners of the Mandalay Bay Hotel. I said that in many stories that I've written. And it all mm-hmm. comes down, in my opinion, and I'm a former director of security and surveillance on the Strip. I used to work at the Riviera and another casino before that. And I actually worked for the MGM Corporation back in the 90s for 5 years. I was an investigator. But mm-hmm. what happened with Paddock, and I blame MGM or I blame the corporation because it's corporate incompetence and ignorance. It all comes down to money. These casinos have been put on notice after the September 11th attacks because I was working as a director. Okay, I went mm-hmm. to the meetings and the training seminars put out by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. We got bulletins, and you're always going to different type of seminars, training, and different types of stuff like that. And they all said you got to take measures because, you know, to effectively take out an active shooter, prevent explosives from coming onto your property. So the industry had 15 years to put something in place, and pretty much mm-hmm. they didn't do anything. And the reason why is, you know, if one property says we're going to start screening luggage and it's going to slow down a guest for 10, 15 minutes or however the process is, and you know how long it takes to screen. It does take that long to screen. I worked for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security at the airport. Screening luggage mm-hmm. doesn't take a long time, you know, and there's machines and stuff that are available that the casinos could very well buy because they have the money to do it that can do it mm-hmm. a lot faster. Well, they don't want to do that. Because they figure if a guest comes in and says, you know, I'm standing around for 15, 20 minutes and I got to wait for my luggage, plus the screening or whatever measures you're going to put in place, it's a hassle to the guest. And the way the casinos right. look at it is this. If we do this and it slows down the, quote, guest, unquote, experience, they're just going to go down the street to our competitor and we're going to lose money. And it's all about the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it comes down to. And I got to tell you something, Trish. Since September 11th, and I have people who talk to me, you know, that's still in the industry, very little has been done to stop, if anything, another person like Paddock or worse from doing the exact same thing. And that's what's a disgrace about it.
And that's shocking. That is absolutely shocking. I'm going to jump around here just a little bit. And Levi Page, don't be shy. Jump in if you have a question, because this is a man that has really a lot of the answers. And speaking of answers, Doug Papa, are we any closer to figuring out why Stephen Paddock did this horrible, monstrous thing?
You have to remember that the Las Vegas Metro Police Department, who conducted the criminal investigation, came out with their preliminary report back in January 19th when it was released. And, of course, they didn't have a motive in there because it was still an ongoing investigation. The final criminal investigative report, which I'll refer to as the final report when we talk about it, that's what I'll call it, that came out August 3rd. And the Sheriff Lombardo, who runs the Las Vegas Metro Police Department, said before it came out and then at the press conference when it was going to be released after he stopped the press conference online, that they don't have a motive. That's unanswered. Now, that's very disappointing to the families and the survivors. They want to know why Paddock did what he did. But, there is, if you read the final report, they interviewed his family members and some other people. And there's not a definitive motive, but based on the interviews they had with the family members, and it's documented in the final report, this guy had some issues. I mean, he was an angry man. He had health issues. He was on some type of medication. I can't remember what it was for something. His doctor, according to the report, thought that he was bipolar, and he was gambling. He lost some amount of money over the past 2 years. So, they said a lot of things about him that depict somebody that has some issues. But, to come to a conclusion to say we actually know this is why he did it, because he hated a certain group of people, he wanted to get back at the casinos, or whatever, that has yet to be determined. And that's frustrating because I've talked to some of these people, since some emails. It's frustrating for them as survivors because they want to know that. Now, the only saving grace in this whole thing as far as motive, the FBI hasn't come out with their report yet. It's supposed to be sometime between now, they said, the anniversary towards the end of the year. And they have the behavioral analysis unit out of Quantico. And what those people do, and they're usually pretty good. They've got a pretty good track record with serial kills and stuff like that. They look at the whole ball of wax. They look at the whole big picture. And they, they interview people. They look at how the crime occurred, what he did before the crime. They look at basically his whole life. And then they come up, they're psychologists, some of them and stuff. And they come up with a conclusion is this is why we believe he did what he did. Now, what we don't know, that's just going to be a conclusion based on, the crime and everything like that. But what we don't know now is what the FBI has that the Las Vegas Metro Police Department doesn't have as far as their investigation. Maybe they do have something that's going to come pretty close to a conclusive motive. So we have to wait and see that. That hasn't come out yet. But, the police say right in there, the motive, we can't answer that. It says right there in the police report.
Well, hopefully at some point, like you said, we'll be able to, at least maybe the FBI will shed more light on it. But if I so many questions and topics I want to get to. But let's first put something to rest once and for all, Doug Papa and Levi Page. Stephen Paddock acted alone. He was one shooter. And can you explain what people were hearing? Wasn't it an echo of other shots, and that's why they thought it was another shooter? But, it's a definitive thing. It was only Stephen Paddock, correct?
Like, I could say this. I could say this, and I wrote that story last week in there. And I analyzed, because I've been asking for the lock interrogation reports for both his rooms for months and months and months, and it was never released, because I said back in January that, and I wrote that in a couple of stories, that I believe, based on what I was hearing from my police sources, and then when the videos came out, the body-worn camera footage, when they went into the room and stuff, I believe that the lock interrogation reports would seal that up, the rumors that were that somebody else was in the room with Paddock and helped him fire out the window. People were firing from both windows. And then somebody shot him in the head. He didn't commit suicide, and they left before the ad hoc SWAT team made the entry into the rooms. The preliminary report did not release, when it came in January, did not release the lock interrogation reports. They put in
now, what is the lock interrogation report? Can you just give us a brief rundown of that?
Sure. I don't know if your listeners know, but if you go to any modern hotel, when you go and you register, they give you a key card like a credit card. And that's encoded at the front desk to your room number. So when you take that key and you put it into your room door for the first time, that electronic lock, it's a little computer in there, when you put the key card in, that negates any other key card that went into that door prior. In other words, if the guy before you or the lady checks out of the room and you check into your hotel room and they still have their key, if once you put your key card into the door, if they come back in the middle of the night and try to get into that room, the lock is not going to allow entry into the room because the new key overrides the guest keys, the prior guest keys. So that's what that is. And what it does is when you put that key card in the door, it registers the type of key that accessed the door. In other words, it'll say guest key, and it'll show who the guest key was issued to. And in this case, for my purposes of talking about this, we'll say Stephen Paddock, okay? Because he checked in, the key cards has his name in the computer, so it's encoded to Paddock. So when he puts the key in, it'll show door opened, and then on the when you print out this report, which is called the lock interrogation report, how you get that is you download the information from the lock, and then it goes into another system, you know, either a standby computer or some of it's hardwired in, but whatever, you get a report of the activity in the door lock. So I've been saying for months that that lock interrogation report, when it's released, will either confirm that nobody came out of that room during or after Paddock fired, or maybe they did, and the lock interrogation would show it. Because the preliminary report, when it came out, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'm just coming off the top of my head, they said something like it was 9:46, the deadbolt was engaged on 1:35, and then 9:46 p.m., the deadbolt was engaged on 1:34, the adjoining room door. Explain something there so people understand what I'm talking about. In a hotel, when you go into your room, the only way a guest can engage the deadbolt, not the door lock, because when you shut the door, that's a spring lock. So the door shuts and it's basically locked. But when you're inside your room, you have a deadbolt on top of the bottom door handle, and that's another safety measure. So when you engage that, in other words, you throw it, it's engaged, the bolt now goes into the jamb of the deadbolt. The only way you can do that, a guest can do it, is from inside the room. And when you do that deadbolt engaging is going to show up on the lock interrogation report. Deadbolt engaged, deadbolt thrown, however they word it. When the door opens on the inside, that will also show. And it also shows the date and time all these manipulations are happening. So when they came out with the preliminary report in January, they said what I just said, that at 9:46, I think it was 9:36 on the other room, that, remember, 10:05 is when he started opening fire. So basically, for what I'm saying here, and easy for people to understand what I'm saying, before he opened fire, somebody in that room hit the deadbolts on both of those doors. Now, I say somebody because we didn't know until the lock interrogations were attached to the final report when it came out August 3rd. They finally attached the lock interrogation reports. But the police report basically didn't explain, and I don't know why, how the lock interrogation report definitely confirms that Paddock was the only one in the room. They just attached it. They don't say nothing. There's a lot of things about that final report that bother me. There's a lot of sloppiness that went on. But anyway, I analyzed it myself because I've used lock interrogations on hundreds of investigations in my 20 years in the hotel casino business, criminal investigations, working with the Metropolitan Police Department and risk management investigations. You want to find out when a guest went inside the room. So when the lock interrogation reports came out August 3rd, I analyze him for about a week. And what I found out is that when he hit, when I say he, somebody in the room right now, and I'll explain why I say that, okay? The lock interrogation comes from the information in the door lock, the electronic lock.
Mm-hmm.
And people have to understand this. The lock interrogation report cannot tell you who put that key in the door. It can only tell you who the key was issued to. In other words, if the key's issued to Doug Papa and I give it to you, it's going to show that Doug Papa accessed the door because the, key, the lock has no way of knowing who's putting the key in the door. So just keep that in mind. So when I analyze the lock interrogation reports, you can see where he goes into the room and it says guest key issued to Paddock. He goes into the room and then the deadbolts go on the door before the shooting. Now, here's what confirmed to me that there was nobody else in the room with him during the fire and after. He engaged those deadbolts, and I could say now, say he, Paddock, okay, before he opened fire. Okay, there's no manipulation. There's the door doesn't open. The deadbolts don't come out that door because the lock interrogations would show that. It stays, there's nobody disengaged those deadbolts even after firing stopped. Now, when the police breached the door at 11:20 p.m. that night, about an hour and 5 minutes after the last shots were fired, the lock interrogation shows at 11:20, door opened from the inside. And the reason why that happened is when they used the explosive charge on the door, when Levi Hancock, the SWAT guy, put the explosives on the door blew apart. The double door separated. And that was 11:20. That's documented in the lock report. And that's because the door didn't know. All the door knew is that it separated. So it showed the door open. So that's 11:20 when the cops go in. The room 32-134, that deadbolt never came off the door. And the next entry after Paddock opened fire is like 7:30 in the morning, and it says on the lock interrogation report, ping from server, because the cops never went through the front door 134. They never opened up the door. They used the adjoining room door. Now, just so you people know, the adjoining room door doesn't have an electronic lock on it. So, you know, that's the door that would connect 134 to 135. So I wrote the story the other day, and I said the lock interrogation reports confirm Stephen Paddock was the only one in the room. Now, people come up with all these conspiracy theories, and I never prescribe to conspiracy theories since day one. I want facts and go on what we know, what people are saying, what the radio traffic shows, and all the documents that came out later on, the witness reports, police reports, and stuff like that. So we know this from the lock interrogation report. He put the deadbolts on the door before he opened fire. They never, the deadbolts never disengaged. He stopped. He starts firing at 10:05. The deadbolts are engaged. He stops firing at 10:15. The deadbolts are engaged. The police make entry into the room at 11:20 at night. The deadbolts are still engaged. Paddock is found dead on the floor by his own hand. They say suicide. So how did anybody else get in or out of that room? If they were in the room with him, assisting him with firing, or they shot him in the head, like some people said, and they left. All a bunch of nonsense. The lock interrogation reports confirm 110% that nobody came out of that room after and during the gunfire. So short of flying out the window and sprouting wings, nobody came out of that room. So, and we know that didn't happen.
Right. And believe me, just give some people enough time and they will eventually have somebody sprouting wings and flying out the window. The conspiracy theories will never die down. You are always going to have people. I heard Rosie O'Donnell talking about it was a some sort of gun deal gone wrong with the FBI. And I'm like, what? Are you nuts? Yeah, it's just, it's absolutely crazy. So I'm glad that you were able.
Well, that was one of the big things, too, from the start, is that he was working for the FBI as an informant or ATF, CIA, and all this nonsense come in. You know, it was he had all these guns in the room because it was a gun running operation. I worked 8 years when I was a detective, a criminal investigator. I worked 8 years undercover, and I did just about everything you can do undercover. I bought drugs, guns, explosives, you name it, I did it. Stolen property. And I'm going to tell you, we used to use, you know, room setups to do different things and stuff, and we have cameras installed like that. His room was not set up as any type of undercover operation. And I'm going to tell you one of the first things that why I didn't prescribe to those conspiracy theories is is because he didn't only have 135, he had the adjoining room 134. That's the mm-hmm. only room that butted up to 135. Okay? When you're doing an undercover operation, at least when we did it, we would always want the adjoining room, whether the UC, the undercover operative, was in one, we always wanted the other room. And that's where we have, you know, our backup, our electronic equipment, the audio recorders, the cameras and everything that, you know, that we watch in the room. You always want to have that adjoining door butted up because, God forbid, something happens and you got to get in there real fast to protect the UC guy, the undercover guy. You won't have that door. Well, that didn't work in his circumstance because he had that room. He had 134, 135. And, you know, those cheesy cameras that were found on the door when the preliminary report came out back in January, if you remember, they actually had, you know, what the room looked like, the photos attached to the report. And you see the cheesy little camera he had the wires running under the door and everything. I mean, come on. You think the government was going to do some type of undercover operation, have a cheesy setup like that? I mean, I did this type of stuff. I worked with the FBI, the ATF, DEA, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I'm telling you, that was just a bunch of nonsense. So, you know, to me, I even said on one of the radio shows, it's absolutely ridiculous. But it's now a moot point, Tricia, because Paddock acted alone in that room when the firing started. Now, I'm not privy to anything. I don't have any documents. Nobody leaked me documents from the FBI. Nobody leaked me police reports. They leaked me information. And I broke a lot of stories. But I don't know if somebody was involved with Paddock, you know, setting this thing up. And did he tell somebody else, how I'm going to go over here and do it? I have no way of knowing that. I don't believe right now that that's the case. But that's just my opinion. I'm not basing that on anything because I don't know. I'm not part of the FBI investigation. I'm not part of the Metropolitan Police Department's criminal investigation. I wasn't doing the investigation myself. You know, now, you brought up the other shots going on at the other properties. And like I said, when that happened that night, and that's why, you know, I know a lot what happened with this thing, is I was monitoring not only the television, two different cable channels, but the minute I found out it happened, which was right as it was happening, because I was on the phone with somebody and their daughter came in and says there's a terrorist incident going on in the strip and, you know, people are running and people are shot, I turned on my police scanner. And at the time, the LVMPD radio traffic was unencrypted. So everything, I recorded a lot of stuff, everything was coming across in plain language across the police scanner. And everything, all the tactical movements of the police, even when the SWAT team was making entry in different buildings to blow it, you heard all that, and you heard it, all that stuff was released on the internet. All that stuff was coming over in plain English, unencrypted. So I listened to, you know, everything in the traffic. Now, about an hour after the gunfire stopped, and I'm just estimating that, it was somewhere like 10 minutes to 11 o'clock and onward, the police start getting inundated with all types of calls of active shooters at other properties. They were called, you know, and they were, you all heard the calls. They were responding to the New York, the Tropicana, Caesar's Palace, the Aria.
Panic.
It was coming in one after the other. Now, that didn't happen. And a lot of people think that happened at the time Paddock was firing. It did not. Most of those calls, almost 99% of them, started well after he stopped firing. But when I heard that, listening, and I was on the phone with a former law enforcement officer, we would, you know, he was listening, I was listening, and we both said at the same time that this is a Mumbai-type terrorist attack, because that's what they would do. They would want to spread out the forces while they can hit another property. You know, Paddock had stopped firing, and all of a sudden now the police are getting all these calls, and several times on the radio, the SWAT commander came on the radio and even said, and we heard that, but this was all in plain English, he said, be careful, something like that, because they may be trying to split our forces up. So they were going under the premise that night that Las Vegas, the Strip, was under attack by multiple shooters. And I believe that also, based on the calls that were coming in, because dispatch was dispatching those calls to other police officers who were forming strike teams. And let me make a definition there. A lot of people get mixed up when they heard strike team and the SWAT team. They were calling the strike teams the SWAT team, and that's incorrect.
What's the difference?
A strike team, Yes, the difference is the SWAT team here in Las Vegas is a full-time SWAT team. That's all they do. Strike teams, when you heard it on the radio at night, they say we have a strike team going into New York, we have a strike team here. A strike team is a group of police officers, usually three or more, three to six, sometimes more, and they just form up automatically by themselves, and they form a team, a strike team. And then they go to the active shooter calls. And they were doing that on the strip. And, you know, to be honest with you, I'm an ex-cop. They did real good in that. Nobody was telling them to do that. In other words, when everything hit the fan, there wasn't a lot of traffic on the radio of commanders saying, you know, Doug, you go over here and you do this, form a strike team.
Right.
You heard on the radio some really good police work. You heard them, come on, give their unit numbers. We just formed a 4 or 5 man strike team. We're going into New York. Somebody else says, I got a 4 man element. Same thing, element strike team. We're going in over here. Nobody told those cops to do it. They did it because of their training. So they started going out to these different properties. And calls were coming in that people, you know, shots were being fired. However, when they went to these properties, they cleared them. There was nothing. And you heard it on the radio. They either met with security. Security says there's nothing going on over here. I did speak to one or two people who, to me, are reliable. And I'll do a story, you know, later on, a week or so down the road on it, that swear it's certain properties that they heard gunshots. You look at it this way. The police did respond, I mean, as fast as they could. They did that response was fast. Now, remember, like I said, these calls came in way after Paddock stopped firing. But still,
right.
I was listening to that night, and as an ex-cop, I'm thinking, okay, he stopped firing. Whoever was firing out of Mandalay Bay, now they're going to do something at some other property, so they're trying to spread out the police force. And the cops were into the same thing. It was like a Mumbai-type attack, and that's what the premise they're going on. But I have police sources, okay, and that's how I did. I broke a lot of stories. Is there were no dead bodies found, people shot in these casinos from shooters that happened at these other properties. Now, here's where a lot of things come into play here. People ran out of the Route 91 Music Festival who were shot and who were injured. They ran into other properties. They found one over in Tropicana. I think one was down the street.
Right.
They were going all
over
the place. So when somebody comes in and they're bleeding, or they're screaming and said, hey, shots, I got shot or something like that. This is well after the firing stopped because people were still hiding into the Route 91 Music Festival well after Paddock stopped firing because they were afraid.
Mm-hmm.
But they just spread out all over the place. So you got all these people going into these different casinos screaming, and some of them actually, you know, fell and died. I think the Hooters restaurant had a lot of people, and people saying now because all these people and ambulances were over there, that these people were shot inside Hooters. No, Hooters was behind east on Tropicana, behind the route. That's where people were running. So, you know, when people say, hey, there were other shooters and there were terrorists in black uniforms and all this type of stuff, it wasn't. And I got to tell you this, okay? If there were terrorists that were in Las Vegas doing this, and Paddock was maybe part of it, like people are saying, and they were doing all these other things, what did terrorists do? They just don't do something and disappear. They stay and they fight to the death. So you would have had gun battles with the police at other properties with these so-called terrorists that were non-existent. So there is no evidence to date that any other shootings, I'm going to put it this way, people were hurt at any other property from gunfire. Yes, there was a lot of calls coming in, but it was unfounded. And from what I heard, you know, I've been doing this for a year, and believe me, if I heard, and I haven't heard nothing that there was this big conspiracy to cover up a terrorist attack in Las Vegas. That is basically a bunch of nonsense. There's a lot of incompetence that went on, certain incompetence with the police before, and definitely with MGM Resorts International. But to say Vegas was, under this terrorist attack and all these terrorists got away and stuff, that is a bunch of nonsense. And it's actually an insult to the cops out there who were responding with these strike teams all over. And I'll give you an example. And one thing that came across the radio, and I believe it was the Bellagio, we got a guy going in with an assault rifle into the employee entrance. That team was something like that, the call out. And everybody responded down there, Liz. Well, what happened with that, from what I understand, was that was the security director who was at home when he heard that the strip was under attack, and he got his own. He responded to his property because he knew everything, you know, was hitting the fan on the strip. And that had turned out to be the security director going in with his assault rifle, you know, to go in to protect
his
property.
Oh, and everybody thought, people reported he was a terrorist.
Got it. By the way, so there's stuff like that that goes out over the radio, or people see something, man, and it turns out to be something different. I don't have the stuff in front of me. There's a couple of things, you know, where people said they saw this and they saw that. But from my police sources that I talked to for over a year, I mean, I'll tell you, Trish, if I found out that there was some type of terrorist or another active shooter that was killing people, another property, and it was covered up, I would have found out about it. And I would have wrote about it. So I don't
right. You would
any,
have
you know,
uncovered it. Right. Well, that's good to know. And that is yes, absolutely. And that's good to know. And it makes a lot of sense. These people are filing, running into these casinos and they're bleeding. You would automatically think, oh, my God, they got shot here. You wouldn't. They didn't know what was going on inside the casino. They would got a couple blocks away. No. So all of that makes perfect sense. And I am so glad that's cleared up, because then now we can focus on the things we need to focus on. And there's two things I want to talk to you about. You touched on one at the beginning where the strip, the Las Vegas strip, and the hotels really haven't done much of anything after 9/11 when they were warned to do so. We'll talk about that in a moment. But I want to talk about Sheriff Lombardo. To say that you have criticized him is an understatement. Talk to me about why you think Sheriff Lombardo is not a good police captain, I guess, police chief. What happened?
Well, let me bring something up there too, because people who don't live in Vegas, they have a lot of questions. They don't understand when I was writing the stories that I get, even to this day, why are you talking about this Sheriff Lombardo? Where was the police chief of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department? And what they don't understand is, back in the 70s, it was the late 70s, somewhere around there. I don't know the exact date. Not important. But they had the Clark County Sheriff's Office the Clark County Sheriff's Office out here, because Las Vegas is in Clark County, Nevada. And they had the city police department, the Las Vegas police. And back in the 70s, you know, it was on TV, you saw that. And at some point in the late 70s, they merged the city police with the Clark County Sheriff's Office, and they formed the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. That's how the LVMPD, that's the initials I call it, that's how that organization formed, and it's to this day, it's the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. However, when they made that, they didn't change the state code or anything. They still said, well, the sheriff of Clark County is still going to run the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Now, the sheriff is an elected official. He runs every 4 years. And he's the head of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. But he's a political, he's a politician. He's also a member of the police department. Joe Lombardo is a career cop. And so that's how, when I say the sheriff and people get confused, where's the police chief? And so, well, they don't have a police chief. The elected
sheriff
in Clark County, Nevada runs the LVMPD. So that's what that is, to clear up anything, because I still get emails from people. They don't understand how that works. So that's how that works.
Got it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I've criticized Joe Lombardo more than any other investigative reporter in the world since October 1st. When he should have been criticized and harshly criticized by local media out here, they didn't. They gave him a free pass. And I don't know why that is. Maybe they just didn't know what he was talking about, but I do. I'm a former cop. I'm a former criminal investigator. Remember, I worked over 20 years in the casino business, director of security and surveillance at different properties, an investigator in the 90s, the late 90s, for the MGM Corporation. So I know when somebody's basically blowing smoke up my butt and saying stuff that makes no sense, or something that doesn't purport to the radio transmissions or the information that I was getting from sources and stuff like that. Like I said, I broke a couple of stories back in October that nobody else even picked up on, some of them even to this day. So anyway, you're absolutely right. Now I want to say this, and I said this to a cop one day who's still working for the LVMPD. I have nothing personal against Joe Lombardo. You know, from what I hear, you know, he's a great family man, and, you know, that has nothing to do with me. I'm not attacking Joe Lombardo, the man, okay?
Okay,
the
father. Okay.
I'm not attacking. I was attacking Joe Lombardo, the head of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, who was in charge, and I say who, his department, so he's basically in charge, of the worst mass shooting investigation in modern American history. Remember, 58 mm-hmm. dead, over 400 shot with bullets and shrapnel, and hundreds of others injured. And almost immediately from the start, for whatever reason, I don't know, I'm not in Joe Lombardo's head, he started mm-hmm. making comments to the press that were either all-out lies, and I could say that because I've written about it, because they were, misleading, convoluted, and kept changing things a lot. That, mm-hmm. his actions, his statements from the beginning perpetrated a lot of these conspiracy theories, okay? Because he mm-hmm. kept changing stuff. He said stuff that absolutely was not true. It was not to what the radio traffic was saying. Why he was doing that? Go ahead.
I was going to say, can you give us an example?
Okay. You know, one of the things they first said was, everybody was interested, is why did it take so long for the SWAT team to breach that door? And originally he said, you know, they had to wait for the full SWAT team. And I think Kevin McMahill, the number two guy, is under sheriff, said, saying, well, you have to wait till the full SWAT team gets there. I can do everything. And that wasn't true. The full SWAT team never got there. They got there much later. The door was breached, and we knew this a week after the October 1st tragedy. It was Sunday, October 8th, if my date's correct, when four officers who were involved with the entry team, patrol officers, went on 60 Minutes, and they were talking. Mm-hmm. We all remember that, okay? And everybody was looking and said, well, they're not SWAT guys. I mean, there were two canine guys, a canine sergeant, there was a uniformed detective who was there, but they were the officers who breached the door with one SWAT officer, Levi Hancock. He was the SWAT team guy who is the explosive breacher who put the explosive door. He formed when he went in there because he responded directly. I'll get into that a little more. I'll get into it now. He responded to, when the call out came for the SWAT team. I'll say this. Okay, this is another thing to date Joe Lombardo hasn't discussed, and I basically broke this story too. I ironed this out. Everybody was upset. Where was the SWAT team that night? Why did it take the police an hour and 5 minutes after Paddock stopped firing to breach the door? Well, because the SWAT team never responded to the Mandalay Bay Hotel. The lieutenant, and I can't remember his name, Huddler, Huddleston, something like that, who was in charge of the mm-hmm. SWAT team commander that night, when the call out went out, and how do I know this? Well, I knew it from police sources, but I also corroborated it when they released through court order all those witness statements and police officer statements released by court order. We found out, I found out, and I did a story on it, that when the call out went out on the communicators for the SWAT team, they were told to respond to the South Central Area Command, which is a half a mile down the strip from Mandalay Bay. They were told not to go to Mandalay Bay. So they went to the South Central Air Command, they were briefed, whatever, and then they went back to the Mandalay Bay. So that was the big delay. However, there were two SWAT officers, and when I did my story the other day, the final police report actually confirms that Levi Hancock, the full-time SWAT guy, and O'Donnell, I forgot mm-hmm. the guy's first name, I'm sorry, but they responded immediately to the Mandalay Bay. Now, they didn't go to the South Central Air Command. That's why when Levi Hancock went in there, he picked a couple of guys that he saw. I think it was Sergeant Bitsko from K-9. It was Dave Newton, the K-9 officer, Detective Donaldson, and so on. He sees other cops in there because cops were flooding the Mandalay Bay, you know, trying to get in there. We'll get into that, too, with Hendricks, the coward. But cops were going into it. So when Hancock gets there, he sees a couple of guys, you're with me. And that's in statements and stuff like that, and it was corroborated from my sources and stuff, and the statements came out like double corroboration. So at 11:20, Levi Hancock explosively breaches 32-135 with what I call his ad hoc SWAT team, because and then when they went in, right behind him was the other SWAT officer, O'Donnell. Everybody else pretty much was down at the South Central Air Command. That was the big delay that they responded down there. There was a SWAT sniper who's on body-worn camera footage right before they breached the door, and he's in the hallway with the big, the 50 caliber sniper rifle, I think it is, or 338, anyway, whatever. But predominantly, that's what happened. And the reason why I was told that, and that was a major screw-up, because you have an active shooter, which is Stephen Paddock. He stopped firing. That's where they now know he was in that suite. Well, that's where the SWAT team should have gone immediately. You get a call out, boom, you go there. Hancock and O'Donnell didn't go there. I heard that, and I don't know, I heard just of cops. He said, hey, you know, the active shooter was up there. I'm going to Mandalay Bay. And so he went over there. That's why he formed that Hancock SWAT team. But the sheriff kept saying, you know, this full SWAT team breached the door and we had to wait for the full SWAT team. That was a delay. That was a lie. How does he not know that? How does the sheriff, who's running the police department, who's involved with the worst mass shooting in history, how does he not know the facts before he opens up his mouth? That was the first thing with a lot of stuff that he said. So that's when I started criticizing him. And it got progressively worse after that. So every time he said something that I felt was a stupid comment or a lie or misleading or convoluted, I wrote about it. And I said this in several of my stories. Had I been the sheriff running the police department, the only thing I would have said that night is this. We have the shooter. You know, he's down. Okay, that's it. You don't have to say anything else. Right now, we have no other reason to believe there's a threat to anybody right now in Las Vegas. Remember, the FBI said that, and then they shut up and didn't say nothing. But he kept running his mouth, you know, sometimes two press conferences a day, and things they were not purporting to what we knew, what I knew from the radio traffic and what I was hearing from some of my police sources. So I started writing the stories. But no, I want to say this, okay? You know, like I said, Joe Lombardo is probably a great guy, great man. You know, he's probably a good cop. But as an administrator, administrating the investigation of the worst mass shooting in American history, he made a lot of mistakes, okay? And he, like I said, he was responsible for these conspiracy theories going like wildfire because that's what they were using. Lombardo said this, then he said this, then he changed this, and we know that wasn't true, and blah, blah. This is what he should have done, and I was going to get into like a couple seconds ago. Ladies and gentlemen, we had a horrible, tragic accident here on the Strip. The shooter is down. He's dead. Right now, we have no reason to believe anybody else was involved. It's safe, and we're just going to continue our investigation, period. Amen. I don't care if I was the sheriff. If every news camera was in my face every day, my comment's going to be, until this investigation's concluded, I am not discussing anything. If it turns out there's something the public needs to know for their safety, I will advise you in a press conference. But until this investigation's concluded, we are not saying anything. Well, he didn't do that. And maybe he didn't do it because he was running for re-election. He wanted his face all over the world. But what got worse after that was this. 2 days after the worst mass shooting in American history, the police department, who was handling the investigation, some of their officers leaked the crime scene photographs to the press. Okay? Those crime scene photographs weren't from the crime scene investigators. They were from people who either had access to the room and it was from their cell phone or something. Anyway, Boston 25 was the first one that did it. They had the guns and stuff. And then somebody the next day let some photographer, I believe it was from California, put a thing and they went in the room and, you know, violated the crime scene. I mean, you know, they breached the crime scene. She took a picture and then you saw the rifle on the floor with the evidence tag. And that really ticked me off because we get so upset about it. I said, this investigation has just started. It's the worst mass shooting investigation in modern American history. And we have some cops, whoever they were, decided most likely for money, because I was told from my sources in the media that those photographs were probably worth upwards of $10,000 a piece. I don't know why they did it, but they did.
Right.
You know? But I was told by one of my police officers' sources that one of the person that released those photographs was somebody in Sheriff Lombardo's command staff structure. And that's all I'll say at this point. So when I wrote that story, I put that in there, that it was a command staff officer who I heard released those photographs to the reporter from Boston. And I think that was a disgrace. And people were sending me the emails, you're making a big thing out of nothing. And I said, no. See, people don't know what they're talking about. They haven't done criminal investigations. Okay?
Right.
Look at it this way. Nobody knew the start of this investigation. whether Paddock acted alone, whether he was part of a terrorist group, whether he was radicalized or was some domestic terrorist group, white supremacy, we don't know nothing. So maybe there were other people involved. When you're doing a criminal investigation, especially a homicide investigation, this was the biggest homicide investigation that this police department has ever done in the history. You don't want people to know what that crime scene looks like. Because if you have a suspect and you're interviewing him, and you say, okay, you know, what were you doing in the room? And you're asking him questions about certain things, the way the room looked and what was in there. You want to make sure, you know, that's secure, that he didn't know anything before. But now that the pictures and the crime scene and the rifles were put all over the world, they compromised the criminal investigation. To this date, Lombardo has not talked about that. Okay, and you know, he said originally when those photographs came out, was, you know, the media were asking him, are they real photographs from the crime scene? He finally admitted yes, they are photographs of the crime scene, and I'm not happy about it, and we're doing an investigation, and that's the last thing of it. And the reason why we're never going to hear about it, even to this date, because they put in that it's a personnel issue, and we're not going to discuss personnel issues, but it's a personnel issue. He even said on an interview, Sheriff Lombardo, in November 2nd with KLS TV out here, that the reporter asked him, he goes something like, George, he says, no, there were 50, 60 people had, you know, had the chain of those photographs and whoever knows. And I did a story on that. And I said, well, you know, hire me for 2 days. I'll get the guy in a second. Because my information was the person who released that photograph had a personal relationship with that reporter from Boston, which used to work out here. So start checking people's cell phones, emails, see who's talking to who. And I'm pretty sure they did that, but we don't know what the result of that investigation. So that was a disgrace. You know, it was a disgrace. Those cops disgraced their own department because it was, like I said, the worst mass shooting in American history, and here you got the police compromising it by releasing crime. So it was stuff like that that happened and other stuff that started these conspiracy theories going. And every time Sheriff Joe Lombardo was talking about something, he contradicted other stuff from radio transmissions and stuff like that. And a lot of times he contradicted himself, okay? And every time he did, I wrote a story about it. I'm not attacking Joe Lombardo, the man, okay? Because I heard he's a good guy. He's a good family guy. I don't care if that's that's his own thing. I was attacking him as the head of the police department who was involved with the worst mass shooting in modern American history. And that's what I got to say, you know, on Joe Lombardo. And I know he doesn't lie. I got people talking to me in the police. I know he doesn't, you know, he lies. Even I think when he even says that the couple of things at some of these press conferences, oh, you got these keyboard bandits, these Monday morning people.
Oh, yes.
Sit at the keyboard.
I've heard him say that, yeah.
I know he's talking about me because there really isn't anybody in the media that was attacking him. I mean, you have the conspiracy theories, stuff like that. But I was the only one because it was a story and there was no lies. I was using what he was saying and saying it's not true or it's convoluted or it's misleading. So that's my take on Sheriff Joe Lombardo. And he did win the election. He was reelected this year for another 4 years.
Right.
So, you know, it is what it is.
Let's go back briefly to the SWAT team. Like you said, this is something these men train for their life, for this the biggest, at the time they didn't know it was going to be the biggest mass shooting, but by God, they knew that there was somebody up by Mandalay Bay and shooting a crowd down below. So this is what every minute of their training is for. What kept them? That's what I don't understand.
Okay.
Why were they sent
out? Right. Here's what happened, Trish. Okay. I have police officers who are retired and active who are my sources for some of these stories. And I could tell you this, the SWAT team, I'm not talking about the commander and the deputy chief who runs it and all those people. I call them the suits, okay? They're the people that, you know, they're at the top. I'm talking about the SWAT guys, the guys who train every day, in essence, to kill an SOB like Paddock because he's killing so many people, okay? They were told to go somewhere else. And they went, except for Hancock and O'Donnell. That's what they were told. Now, here's what I found out, okay? The lieutenant who was the SWAT commander that night was only the SWAT commander for a couple of months, 6 months, because the normal SWAT commander, I believe his name was Melton, He was on administrative leave, sitting at home on the taxpayer dime since July because he was being investigated for felony fraud involving defrauding some elderly person with some more people. So that SWAT commander, who was the experienced guy, was sitting at home since July of 2017. So this other guy came in, and one of the things I criticize in my stories with this new guy is that he's never been a SWAT guy. And I got a big thing, and I'm an ex-cop. And I saw it when I was working undercover. You know, you have supervisors come in and say, hey, this is how the operation is going to go. And I was, no, BS. I tell you how it's going to go. You don't tell me as the undercover how the operations go. You never worked undercover. It's my butt. I'll tell you. So what happened with this is they put an inexperienced lieutenant who's never been a SWAT officer in charge of the SWAT team. Okay, and that's who was there on October 1st. And for some reason, that's what, you know, Mabato's not talking about. We do know this because it was not only documented from my police sources, but it was documented in the police officers' reports, the SWAT reports, when they came out and they were released by court order. And they say, when the communicator, the system that they're, you know, they're at home and also the communicator also tells the way to go, it said, respond to the South Central Area Command. So that's why they were all over there. Now, late, but you also got to remember this. People got to remember this. SWAT teams, you know, for certain instances, they're okay. A long barricaded suspect, the hostage thing, something like that. But you got to remember, the SWAT teams are not going to be there when the crime actually occurs. Okay? And especially out here, the SWAT team out here is one of the few SWAT teams in the country who are full-time SWAT guys. You know, some departments, they're patrol officers, whatever, and they ride around, they do the regular duty. When they get a SWAT call out, you know, they don their stuff, and then they'll come their SWAT guys. You know, it's not a full-time SWAT team. Out here, the LMT SWAT team is, they're full-time SWAT guys. And you know, it's one of the best, they're one of the most highly rated SWAT teams in the country. You know, other SWAT teams come out here one or two times a year, from what I'm told, from my police sources, and they actually train with our SWAT team out here. Because they have a really good reputation. I think they have more explosive breaches, you know, use of explosives to breach walls and doors than I think any SWAT team in the country, even more than LAPD. So they come out here to do a lot of training, and they train a lot of this way. So those guys, because, you know, I'm an ex-cop, okay? I worked undercover. I was a patrol guy. I got into the mess. I was always looking for stuff to get into. Those SWAT guys, when they got called out, probably wanted nothing more, okay, to kill Stephen Paddock. But by the time they get the call out, you know, Paddock was only fine for 10 minutes. So Paddock's not there. But still, he was an active shooter as far as I'm concerned, because they never made contact with them. And that was that 1 hour and 5 minute delay, which I think is a disgrace. That was because of command, not because of, I put it this way. Okay, and I don't want to get Levi Hancock in trouble, because I heard he might have gotten trouble because he responded directly there. But if Levi Hancock was the SWAT commander, and you got a guy shooting from the 32nd floor of a Mandalay Bay hotel, and he's just shot and killed hundreds of people, and that's the call that went out, if they call me up and tell me that, and I'm the SWAT commander, I'm going to be telling my guys, you get your butts over to Mandalay Bay right now and get in the property. Because remember this.
Yes.
Patrol officers, Tricia, were running into the Mandalay Bay Hotel through the gunfire. So that's where the SWAT team guys should have went. But thank God Levi Hancock and O'Donnell got there, because if Levi Hancock would have responded down to the South Central Command, they would never have been checked over at 1120. God knows it would have been much later on. So that's what happened that night. It was the fault of command, as far as I'm concerned. I'm saying this, not the fault of the line level SWAT officers, because that's what they train for. It's like, you know, a Delta Force operator or special forces who train all the time to kill the bad guy. And then they get called out, and some commander says, oh, no, you're going to go over here, take time, we're not going to do nothing. So I don't blame the, you know, the SWAT officers. I blame somebody in command. And whether it was the lieutenant or somebody over him, whoever made it, but boom, that's what happened that night. So let's, you know, that's cleared up right now, because I know the SWAT team across the country got a really bad rap, because they were saying the SWAT team went in an hour and 5 minutes later. It wasn't really necessarily true, because it was only one guy that breached the door with his ad hoc, and then O'Donnell was behind him. But that's what happened that night. So don't blame the line level SWAT guys. I know I get upset about this because I was a cop for a long time, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I saw stupid, incompetent people in leadership positions who should never have been there. The only reason why they're there is because they have the opportunity, while other cops are working, to go on the city or the county's time and get all these college degrees when they're supposed to be working and they were at college, and they get all these degrees, they pass all these tests, half of them never did squat when they were patrol officers, and all of a sudden now they're in command decisions, making decisions on cops, what's going to happen, like something happened over here with this thing. So there was a lot of incompetence that happened that night with the Metro Police Department command structure, and FISAC, and prior, and to the threat posed by a sniper from an elevated position, too. We can get into that.
Doug, I actually we're running out of time, but there is one thing I want to cover. And we talked about this off the air, and I still haven't recovered from hearing this. The MGM Corporation is suing survivors. Is that right?
Yes, it's basically a ploy so they can get the case handled in federal court because they think it's going to be better off for them. And in essence, what all that is boils down to a nutshell. And I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, so this is not coming legally. But this is what I understand from talking to lawyers and understanding. Okay, they filed this lawsuit because after 9/11, the Patriot Act and everything. This, and I don't have the exact name of this law, but it came out, and basically what it said was, if a company that provides services to another company are certified by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and that company is working for another company, and something happens, like a terrorist incident or something like that, they can't be sued. The company that hired this certified company from U.S. Department of Homeland Security cannot be sued. That's the premise that MGM Resorts and now is going on. Now, what is the company I'm talking about? I don't know the company's name, it was security something, but they hired this company who was certified by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to handle the security, the unarmed security, at the Route 91 venue, because MGM Resorts International owns the concert venue grounds. They own it, so they were putting on the show. So they hired this vendor, this contractor, to provide yellow shirt guys to say security, and they handle the crowds and stuff like that. Because that company is certified by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and this act was passed after 9/11, MGM is stretching that to this. They're saying, well, since we had this company that was out there at the venue, all these other lawsuits that we have pending because we failed to provide proper security measures that would have prevented Paddock from bringing these guns and explosives onto the property, they're now saying that law is now going to roll over to their own security force. And I'm telling you, just as an ex-cop and a layman, I think that's a bunch of BS. So in essence, what they did was, as you know, that when you file a lawsuit against anybody, you have to serve them with papers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, you have a certain amount of time to do that, the case gets thrown out. Now remember, they're suing the victims, in essence, who were at the Route 91. Not only the people who were killed, but the survivors and everybody. There's thousands of them. So they have to go out and hire private process servers, private investigators. Some of these people came from Canada and stuff. They're all over the United States. They have to hire these people to locate them, then serve them, then return the service to the court that these people were served. So they came out with this thing that we understand it was, is that we give you $500 if you let us know where you are and you take service of the paper. You get a $500 check. And then MGM is making it sound like, well, they're going to get money before the lawsuit down the road, and it's like it's to help them. It's not to help the victims. It's to help MGM Resorts International, because I'm going to tell you, it's going to cost them, okay? I worked for that stuff after I was cop, so I know how it goes, okay? It's going to cost them more than $500 per person to have private process servers and private investigators hunting these people down and locating them and serve them more than $500. So they come up with this thing, we're going to sue you because we want this case in court. They're not really suing them for money. But the thing is, it's still a freaking disgrace because these people don't need any more trauma in their life.
Good God,
okay?
No. Exactly. I'm sorry, that's the essence
of what MGM Resorts and Nationals do. It's a freaking disgrace. And I'll tell you right now on the show, Jim Murren, the CEO of MGM, you're a freaking disgrace. I don't care what you say on your news that you're doing this or that. You're doing this to protect your bottom line and your company. You're a freaking disgrace. That is why they're doing it. So I said it. I got no problem
saying
it.
You're absolutely right. Me, a total layman, you don't sue a survivor or the families of those that were killed. You just don't. I don't care what reason you give. There is no good reason that will help the survivor or the family members of the deceased if you sue. Doug, it's just, and again, it just goes along with everything else.
It's a shame. These people got enough. They're going through enough, and they come up with some BS legal maneuver that's only protecting the stockholders and the bottom line. And I hope that it does affect their bottom line. I hope years down the road, and I may even be around to see it, when these lawsuits get settled and stuff, and they're going to get settled. Now, I'm making a prediction right now. They're going to get settled out of court somewhere down the road, and it's going to be for multi-millions of dollars per lease. I hope it burns that corporation because I think they're a freaking disgrace. And like I said earlier, they should have had security measures in place to prevent this because those casinos, I worked for casinos, were told for 15 years, we've had terrorist incidents in this country, we had sniper attacks in this country, and they didn't want to do anything with their security forces because, one, security is not a revenue-producing department, so they get very little stuff, the marketing, everybody else gets it. And the thing is, like I said, you take a security measure over here, we check bags, and it's going to inconvenience the guests for 15 to 20 minutes. They're going to get tired and go down to our competitor. It's all about the bottom line with these casinos. And it's a freaking disgrace because people were killed and wounded 1 year ago tomorrow in Las Vegas, Nevada. And the only thing MGMRI cares about is their bottom line. That's what it is in a nutshell, Tricia.
That's awful. And, Doug, I just want to let everybody know, Doug Papa has literally been spending night and day working on these stories to uncover this because nobody else is. The local media isn't, which is, again, appalling. National media certainly isn't. I believe Tucker Carlson did some shows, but nothing like you, Doug. And I know it's draining and stressful, but I, for one, really appreciate it. I know everybody on WebSleuth appreciates your work. What do you have coming up as far as the next article? Do you have it set yet, or is it going to happen in a couple of weeks, or what?
No, I did, I think, 5 or 6 articles this week already. Actually, the last one I got a lot of emails on, and briefly, in a nutshell, what that was is in 2011, and I'll tell you this to your viewers real quick, the Sahara Hotel closed, and it was undergoing renovations, and it turned into, reopened it as the SLS Resort. That's what it is now. There was a period of time after it closed in, I think, May 2011, before the renovation started, it was basically abandoned. Well, the property was used as a training exercise that involved the FBI, the LVMPD, and there were some security professionals from Las Vegas who attended. In essence, what happened was they had set up a mannequin in one of the high-rise towers of the Sahara to simulate basically a sniper, shooting down onto the strip. And an FBI hostage rescue team sniper from Quantico, an FBI helicopter, hovered over the strip and took the shot and hit the sniper in the window, which was basically the mannequin, Why is that important? Because the only reason why you do a training exercise is because there is a perceived threat. Because, one day something is going to happen. So how can we, extinguish the threat? So they did this training exercise in 2011. Now, a lot of people don't know, in 2014, at the Mandalay Bay in November 2014, there was a guy named Kai Dunbar, a convicted felon, multiple convicted felon, his wife, who had a room in one of the towers high up in the Mandalay Bay. A maid goes in there and sees this assault rifle pointed towards the window, and there's a bunch of other guns in there. So she calls security, Metro gets involved, the FBI got involved, and I did that story the other day. They took out, I think, 3 or 4 semi-automatic rifles, a homemade suppressor, commonly called a silencer, some handguns. Anyway, they took them away. They actually investigated him at the time for a terrorist investigation, but they found out that he was going to do shooting somewhere else. So anyway, that happened in 2014. Okay, now, let's go back to the sniper training. I was told by a former high-ranking member of the Las Vegas Metro Police Department that one of the people in attendance at that sniper training was an MGM executive who was in charge of corporate security and surveillance for the MGM. Now it's the MGM. At the time it was MGM Mirage, I think. MGM Mirage now Resorts International. So that training happened in 2011. Now you got this incident in November of 2014 at the Mandalay Bay. Then all of a sudden, you have the Route 91 festival being planned. And it's surrounded by high-rise towers. It was the first major event on the strip outside channels. And my thing was in the story is, why didn't anybody at the Las Vegas Metro Police Department or MGM Resorts and National, because their executive in charge of corporate security knew of the threat because he was attending the training. Then they had the incident in November 2014, but nobody says, hey, let's look at this venue. Wow, across the street, we have New York, New York. Behind us is the Tropicana. Across the street, the Excalibur, the Luxor, MGM Grand. What if a sniper shoots down from over here? Remember, we did that training a couple of years ago. Very possible. And then we had this other guy in the hotel in 2014. I want, whether it was MGM or Metro, I want snipers standing by. Okay? Now, a lot of people criticized me in emails when I said this. And it's not BS. You know why it's not BS, Tricia? Because they don't have the Route 91 Music Festival. They canceled it. But they have the Life is Beautiful concert at the end of September for 3 days. And you got to remember, the Life is Beautiful concert, from what we believe from the police report, was on Paddock's list that maybe he was going to talk. He was even checked into the Ogden, which overlooked the Life is Beautiful, while he was also checked in the man. But he didn't do anything at Life is Beautiful. So my sources told me in July that there were going to be SWAT snipers deployed in different areas during Life is Beautiful. And lo and behold, right before it was the end of all September, Metro finally came out and said, at this Life is Beautiful conference here, we're going to have snipers deployed, but we're not going to tell you where. So my source was correct. Now, if snipers are useless, I want to make this point here. If snipers are useless for a situation, then why the hell are they deploying them at Life is Beautiful? Which they should. I got no problem with them. To me, I have cops and snipers all over the place for every event. But they did. Now, here's another thing I want to bring up. When they released the police reports, see, I read things, I read thousands of reports, okay? There was a detective, and I think his name was Bolinek or something like that. I don't know if I'm saying it right. But anyway, he was working the night of the concert. He was working off-duty at the concert or something. Maybe it wasn't their fault. But anyway, long story short, when Paddock was firing, according to his police statement, okay, he got a pair of binoculars. And listen to this. He looks up and he says that I saw, while the firing was going on, a figure at the broken-out window. He didn't see firing, but he saw smoke. So he saw Paddock, he saw the shooter. He says he tried to get on the radio, but there was so much confusion he couldn't get on. Why am I bringing that up? Because had SWAT snipers been standing by at the Route 91 Music Festival, could they have been able to intervene in that 10-minute period when Paddock was firing? Obviously, this cop saw the shooter, Paddock, while he was firing at the window. He says that in his report. He was standing at the firing position. He didn't see the light, but he saw the smoke. My thing is they weren't. Why? Because nobody at Metro or this guy in charge of corporate security, MGM or I, said maybe we should have snipers standing by. Because you know what? Now they do have snipers standing by. And let me tell you this. The night of the massacre, October 1st, after Paddock stopped firing, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department did deploy their SWAT snipers in a helicopter. And I wrote about this in a story a couple months ago, and I hit on it again the other day. But Paddock had already stopped firing, okay? My police sources told me that this was prior to the breach of the room, okay? SWAT snipers in the helicopter. He had optics and stuff on his rifle capable of looking into the room. He was in the police chopper. But the chopper pilot didn't want to get close enough because he thought that somebody may open fire again, so they didn't get close enough to look in there. Then what happened was, if your listeners remember, is when they released the body-worn camera footage of the AFS mm-hmm. SWAT team, Hancock and his guys, going into the room, and they breached it. You mm-hmm. hear on that audio, if you go back and listen, you hear one of the cops on the radio talking to J.R. He names him, J.R. Now, I know the guy's last mm-hmm. name. I didn't put in my story, but his name is J.R. Okay? J.R.
Okay.
was the SWAT sniper who was in the helicopter when they breached the
mm-hmm.
room. My point being is this. This was all done after the fact. Why
mm-hmm.
the hell didn't somebody at the command structure of Metro and MGMRI, who was responsible for the safety of those guests, when their corporate security guy knew of a threat posed by a sniper from an elevated position, because he actually tended the damn training when they took
mm-hmm.
the mannequin out, then they had that incident in 2014, why didn't anybody say, maybe we should have some snipers standing by just in case something happens, because it may have made a difference. As a matter of fact, I'm telling you, I know the SWAT snipers, that they're experts. It would have made
mm-hmm.
a difference. During that 10-minute period when Paddock was firing, there's a very good chance lives could be saved. But you know what? They learned from their mistakes, and then at the Life is Beautiful concert, snipers was deployed, and thank God nothing happened. Because as far as I'm concerned, you know, I don't care about political correctness. I don't care what people think or nothing. I'm going to say this. After everything that happened, okay, and there's going to be some,
mm-hmm.
I hate to say this, but there's going to be another event in Las Vegas. It's just a matter of time when it's going to happen. There's going to be one or more people. It's just,
right.
it's just going to happen. But the New York City Police Department has a group called the Hercules Team. And they're basically an anti-terrorist, like SWAT team guys. They dress with the,
mm-hmm.
you know, the assault weapons and the whatnot. And they walk in different locations. Times Square, they're on buses, they're on train stations, they're all over the place. Every day. I think there's like 500-600 of them now. It's a continual thing. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We need that in Las Vegas. I don't care if it looks
yeah.
bad, because they don't want mm-hmm. cops looking like that, walking up and down the strip. But I can tell you, if Metro would start a Hercules team modeled after NYPD, that just may be
mm-hmm.
a deterrent to the next guy or group
oh.
that's going to say, hey, we can just walk into a casino and start shooting people. Listen, no, by the time the cops get there, we shoot out, we kill people. See, I think of prevention. I think like a cop.
Mm-hmm.
I think like a terrorist. What would I do?
Mm-hmm.
What is going to stop me? But you know what? You'll never see that in Las Vegas, because the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors basically runs the city with the casinos. It's an image thing. Oh, no, no. We can't have cops with assault rifles walking up and down the strip. You know, a lot of the cops that night, because you got to remember something, too. I'll say this real quick. I know we're running out of time. When that shooting started, the cops in the venue, and because of the echoes and stuff, even people, they thought there was actually
mm-hmm.
shooters in the venue. And what do you hear on the radio, which I think was, and I'm destroying this, the freaking disgrace. They're calling in. They're asking for somebody with rifles. I need a
mm-hmm.
rifle. Those are the cops, because they thought there was actually shooters in there. They're asking cops for the rifles. Remember, the cops in there, their rifles, if they had them, were in their patrol cars, which were parked way away from the concert venue.
Far away.
So that's why when that happened, they didn't know who was shooting. They didn't know if there were people shooting from the inside, outside. But, you know, now
mm-hmm.
they change it. Now they have, like, rifle deployment teams and stuff like that. But that's my point, okay? If somebody
mm-hmm.
would just thought with a little bit of imagination, like they said in 9/11, it was a failure of imagination, somebody would have just thought, let's have some sniper teams and some rifles ready. God,
mm-hmm.
you know, Paddock maybe wouldn't be able to continue firing for that 10 minutes. Maybe he would have been able to been suppressed or was pushed back to the window. They could have went in. You know, it's all done and over. But it's such a freaking disgrace, because 58 people are dead. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I get emotional. I'll tell you why. Because I've talked to some of the survivors, and I've met some of them, and I talked to some of the family members of people who were killed. And I just look
mm-hmm.
at it like, you know what? We're getting to a point in this country where everything is politically stinking correct, especially when it comes to police work. Oh, no, no, you can't have cops with guns in their car and walking around with this and that. Well, you know what? Wait till the next incident happens here or somewhere else. And that's the big thing we have in this country. People always react after. Why didn't the FBI know about this? Why didn't the cops know about this? But they're the first ones to come out and say, I don't want the FBI snooping in my personal affairs. I don't want the Patriot Act. Well, you know what?
Right.
It's a different world, people. We're in a different
mm-hmm.
world, and it's going to be like that for decades, long after I'm dead and your kids are dead. We have to
mm-hmm.
face the facts and step up and say we got to take the measures to protect the public. That's all I got to say on that point.
Well, Doug Papa, I know it does affect you deeply. And I'm sure it does get lonely out there being the only voice trying to tell the truth about what happened on October 1st, 2017 in Las Vegas. But again, please know that people all over the world appreciate your work, and we want you to continue. Web Sleuth is here for you if you need any help with anything, if you need any research, or just let us know. We have a whole group of people just sitting around saying, what can I do for Doug Papa, really? So don't hesitate to ask if you need help, and please take care of yourself, okay? Try and get some rest. I worry about your rest, so because that's my job. In addition to doing this show, I worry about you and your resting. So get some sleep, take your vitamins, and take care, okay?
I appreciate it, Tricia. I appreciate your listeners. And, you know, I'm just glad, you know, I'm 63 years old. I'm retired. I'm on Social Security. I'm just glad I had the opportunity with my situation since October 1st. Remember, it's like over 110, 120 stories for the Baltimore Post-Examiner just on the massacre alone. And I'm just glad I have the time to spend on it, because I read everything and I analyze everything. And that's one of the comments I get from people, too, is we like reading your stories because you explain what you're talking about, and we understand it. I write my stories like I'm doing a criminal investigation. So, and I'll continue to do as more, you know, as there's stories to write, I'll just continue to do it until we get all the answers and stuff. So we got to see right now what the FBI report is going to say when they come out. But, you know, pretty much, and I said at the beginning, pretty much the FBI hasn't said nothing. And that's the way it should be. That's the way it should have been. There shouldn't be that with the police. You don't say nothing, okay? The guy's dead. You know, we're doing an investigation, and unless I got something else to tell you, just leave me the hell alone. But, you know, these sheriffs and police chiefs in situations like this, they got to get their big faces on television and get the publicity. And it's nobody's business. It's not the reporter's business and nothing to nothing. Hey, we're doing a criminal investigation, end of story, and nothing's going to be released. But it didn't happen that way, and that's sad. But hopefully they learn their lesson.
Well, thank you, Doug Papa. And don't forget, you can read all of Doug Papa's stories in the Baltimore Post-Examiner. And, Mr. Papa, we're going to have you on again really soon. So, again, take care of yourself. Okay?
Thanks, Trish. And good evening, Levi. It was nice talking to you earlier. And thanks a lot, Tricia.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Mr. Levi, are you there? Levi Page. Hello. Levi? Levi, where did you go? You said you were here. Hello, Levi. Levi Page, you said you were here, and I'm sitting here, and I see your phone, and it's the microphone's on, and I'm going to text you right now, and then next time I see you, I'm going to smack you upside the head because you're not there when I'm trying to talk to you. Hold on. Where are you, Levi? Where are you, Levi? Do you need to call back? Give me a smoke signal. Do something. Levi, where are you? Oh, he said it disconnected. Okay. So, Levi, call back in. Let me tell him to call back in. Harry was getting all mad at him, threatening to beat him up. Okay, call back. There we go. Call back. Let's call back. Okay. Now, I had Levi on the show because we have an exciting announcement. We've already put it on Facebook, but we haven't specifically talked about it. And that's what I want him to talk about tonight, is we're teaming up. And I don't know why we haven't done this sooner, but Levi and I were, the first two to actually do true crime podcast series. And Levi, are you there?
I'm here, Trish. I don't know what happened there.
Oh, I don't either. So Levi, was you and beat you up and everything. I'll forgive this time. Considering it was me who hung up on you, so I do. It was probably me. But I was just saying that you know, you and I were the first ones to do true crime podcasts, basically, weren't we?
We were way back during the Casey Anthony trial when we were like the only ones that had them.
Exactly. And now I mean, how many hundreds of true crime podcasts do you see? And they're huge. They're wildly huge. And so Levi called me the other day and said, you know what? We should team up. And I'm thinking, damn, why didn't I think of that? That's a great idea. So Levi, tell everybody what we're going to be doing here starting next year.
Yes, so hopefully we can launch in 2019, and we are launching a podcast titled Into the Case, and it will be a podcast where we focus on one case per season, and we're going to be focusing on missing people and unsolved homicides, cold cases, and hopefully give them some much-needed exposure. And we're planning on making this an investigative podcast where we actually can do our own independent investigation, digging around, and hopefully go on location to do interviews and see for ourselves what the scene is like, you know, the community where these crimes and disappearances happen at, and be able to really dig into this like a detective would.
And that's going to be so exciting. And I know you're going to love it. And we have a case already picked out. I don't think we've said it yet, have we, Levi?
We have not said it yet, but it is a horrific, horrific murder case. And I think that this is a case that has intrigued people on Web Sleuths. It is well-known, but it's not too high-profile. And it has a lot of mystery and intrigue in it, and it's something that people really want to know the answer to, and it's stumped everyone, and it seems to have also stumped law enforcement. So it's going to be interesting to dig into this.
It really is, and it's, boy, is it gruesome. It's shocking and gruesome. We'll be announcing that at some point, but we're going to try and start it. Is it May is our launching time, I believe?
Yes, we may start before then, but it will be around May when we launch.
And like you said, we're going to, you and I will basically split up. You'll handle one part, I'll handle the other, and I'm sure we're going to get some other people involved helping us. It's going to be big, it's going to be exactly what you love, and it's going to be very expensive, especially in the beginning. Now, of course, we hope we do make money off of this so we can put money back in and continue to make the podcast grow. That's how that works. But until then, Levi and I are not rich. I know that's shocking. But, hey, I swear to God, I just barely got my water running in my little cabin. I mean, talk about pathetic. So we have set up a GoFundMe, and it will be used for all of the things we need. We need equipment. We need to get professional editors. We need to get somebody to write some music. There's all kinds of things. What is the GoFundMe address? Is it the name of the podcast? I'm sorry, I'm so lost. I can't remember what it is.
You can go to my Facebook, facebook.com/LeviPageTV. That's all one word, LeviPageTV. And on my Facebook page, you'll see the GoFundMe link. And you can also contribute on PayPal at paypal.me/crimeandscandal, and crime and scandal is all one word, and the money will be used to produce this podcast. You know, like Tricia said, we do not have the backing of a large network, so we're funding this ourselves, and any listeners that are interested that want to help us bring exposure to cold cases, disappearances, unsolved homicides, please contribute. Even if it's, you know, not that much, just do what you can, and it will go to a good cause and help us get this podcast off the ground, because we don't have the backing of a network. And as you know, everything is all political on television these days. It's all politics. There's not a lot of journalism being done regarding crime victims and unsolved homicides and cold cases, so we have to do this ourselves independently. So I hope the listeners help us out. It'll be a huge help to us.
And I'm sure they will. But you're right, Levi. You turn on any show. Ashley Banfield does do true crime, but she has an hour, actually 40 minutes, and can't get into the meat and potatoes of the crime like Levi and I are going to do. So, yeah, we can. And the thing is, we're not going to be asking for money all the time. We hope very, very soon after our first season, if not before. we'll
yes,
be able.
Yes, we can get ad revenue. We can get ad revenue to fund the rest.
Right. This is just the very, very beginning. And Levi, I am so thrilled that you asked me. I cannot wait to do this. This is going to be incredible. And like I said, I'm mad at myself for not thinking of it any sooner. So anyway, I thank you, my friend. I really do. It's going to be a very...
You're welcome. And I think it'll be great to get web sleuthers involved in this case as well.
Yes. Yes. They will definitely be a big part of this. As we go along, you know, I'm sure we can turn to them for some help as well. And when do you think we should announce the case? Should it be just maybe a couple of months before the show? I'm not sure.
Maybe in the new year we could.
There we go. Maybe it could be a New Year's announcement. That would be great. Hey, Levi, tell me what's going on with you. I saw you had a new crime and scandal. And who is that with? It looked fascinating.
It is with Bill Thomas. Bill Thomas is a member of Web Sleuth, so people probably know who he is. He is the brother of Kathy Thomas. She was one of eight people killed in the late 80s. She was killed in 1986 along the Colonial Parkway in Virginia. And this is a series of eight murders, and this killer, many believe it's a serial killer, preyed on couples. She was with her girlfriend, and there were other people, couples, that were killed as well, and it's unsolved. After nearly, you know, over three decades has gone by, and this has gone unsolved. And Bill Thomas is incredible. He lays out this case like a reporter, but he's not a reporter. He's actually the brother of a victim who's been personally, he and his family have been personally impacted. And when you talk to him about this case, he's like a dictionary about this case. And
he is.
I admire his dedication, and I think that people will really be interested in this case, and hopefully Bill can get this case solved. It was a great interview, and you can listen. You can go to iTunes or your Apple Podcasts app. Just type in Crime and Scandal. Make sure you're subscribed. It's the latest episode. If you're on Google Play, you can type it in there if you have an Android phone, or just type in Crime and Scandal podcast on Google, and you'll find all the ways to listen. It was an incredible
I had
interview.
The great pleasure of meeting and spending some time with Bill Thomas at CrimeCon, and you can't find a nicer guy. I said, Levi, incredibly dedicated. So I'm anxious to hear this show as well. I'm sure. Let's hope for Bill's sake and for all. Somehow they find this maniac who did this. This is just awful. But, yeah, great guy. You couldn't say enough nice. I can't say enough nice about you, Levi. You're a great guy. Until we work together, as long as you just joke and worship me like the goddess I am, we'll be fine. Okay? I think that's fair.
As long as you don't ask me to do any sacrifices for you.
Fair. Hey, thank you, Levi Page. We will talk again real soon, okay?
All right, I'll talk to you soon, Tricia.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Okay, well, that's it, my friends, for the live version of Web Sleuths Radio, also known as Web Sleuths Podcast. But because I'm such an old bat, I call it radio. It was called when I first started. It hadn't even yet. We just call it radio, okay? WebSleuths.com, that is the place if you want to discuss cases. We have so many missing cases that have zero, and they really need it. So if you want to make a difference, come to websleuths.com, scroll down, look for the missing form, look for missing, click on it, and then just start posting on a case. Even just, hello, I'm thinking of you and your family. It can mean so much to the families of the missing. So thanks again, everybody. We'll see you next time on Web Sleuths Radio. Tricia Griffith saying so long. Take care. Bye-bye.